direction, I suddenly saw him standing directly between me and the exit, engaged in a conversation with two people I also didn't want to talk to. I couldn't very well skirt past the former president without it seeming like I was snubbing him, so I stopped and stood awkwardly, respectfully, a few feet away. Bush saw me and suddenly made a beeline right toward me. "Remember where we were the last time we saw each other?" he asked. Yeah, I said, "Iowa." I had been covering the Iowa straw poll for George Magazine in August 1999 and met Bush at a small event in someone's backyard in Indianola. "Do you remember what I asked you?" I asked him. "No." "Okay. It was when the cocaine stuff was coming out, and I said I wasn't interested in that, but since we were in Iowa, I wanted to ask whether you had ever manufactured any crystal meth." He nodded, perhaps wondering where I was going with this. "And you outsmarted me," I continued. Now he had it. I didn't answer, did I? "No, and that was smart, because if you had, I would have said, then why won't you answer the cocaine question?" He nodded. I decided to change the subject. "You know what I always liked about you is that you like comedy." "I do," he confirmed enthusiastically. "I remember you said that your favorite movie was Austin Powers."
"Still is."
"And I remember you're taking a risk by going on Letterman via satellite."
He remembered that. "That was a mistake."
"Staff error, sir." I could tell he appreciated that. I continued. "And you told a very risky joke that I admired you for, because I can't imagine anyone on your team thought it was a good idea. Do you remember it?"
"No."
"Well," I said, "Dave asked you, you say you're a uniter, not a divider. What does that mean? And you said via satellite, well, if you had open-heart surgery, I'd sew you back up." Now, this had been just a few months after Dave had open-heart surgery.
And that got a big laugh, right?
No. See, you were on satellite, and you didn't see it, but Dave turned to the audience and completely sold you out. I'm not sure he understood that I was giving him a compliment for taking the risk rather than reveling in how badly he had bombed, but in either case, he came back with an upbeat comment. "Well, you were always my favorite comedian on Saturday Night Live." I made a face, clearly indicating that I wasn't buying that for a moment.
"Okay," he said with a big grin. "I was lying."
"Well," I responded, "you're my favorite president." He laughed and gave me a big high five. Holy mackerel, I liked him. Now I understood how he got elected twice. Or once, if you're one of the people who constantly call in to Air America. Chapter 35. The 64% Rule. In order to be an effective Democratic senator, you have to be able to hold two inherently contradictory ideas in your head at the same time without suffering a cerebral hemorrhage. One, Republicans are just awful. They're beholden to corporate special interests, they're dishonest and or crazy, they're so cynical that they willingly thwart badly needed programs for the sake of their own selfish political motivations, and they've broken Washington irrevocably. So if we care about making progress in America, we need to fight them at every turn. Two, Republicans exist. And they care about our country just as much as we do, if not always exactly in the same way we do. We do not have a monopoly on power. How's that for an understatement? And the truth is, neither do we have a monopoly on good ideas. So if we care about making progress in America, we need to work with them. My friend Mike Enzi, a Republican senator from Wyoming, has what he calls the 80% rule. Republicans and Democrats, Mike says, actually agree on 80% of any given piece of legislation. So, if we focus on that 80% and ignore the 20% where we disagree, we can get a lot done. I think Mike may be a little too optimistic. Some issues, there's just no common ground. If some of us believe that you should be allowed to bring military-style assault weapons onto public transportation, and others of us think that's insane, there's no 80% there. We just have to argue about it and then take a vote and live with the outcome, at least until we win some more elections.
Mike's 80% rule, in my estimation, only applies charitably to about 80% of what we do in the Senate. Hence, Franken's 64% rule. The good news is that there's a lot you can get done in that 64%. Take one of the issues where we have actually made some bipartisan progress during my time in the Senate. Education. Everyone agrees that there's nothing more fundamental to our nation's success than education. 100% of politicians say that 100% of the time. Now, there are some basic fault lines between Democrats and Republicans on this issue. Generally speaking, Democrats support teachers' unions, public school systems, and a strong federal role in education, while Republicans believe in more local control of education and believe that competition in the form of school vouchers will improve the quality of schools. Also, some conservatives used to secretly support the voucher movement because they wanted to undermine public education in order to advance God's kingdom by diverting funding from public schools to religious schools. I say used to because with Betsy DeVos now running the Department of Education, they no longer bother keeping it a secret. Anyway, those fault lines were scrambled in 2002 when George W. Bush signed into law his signature education bill called, with unintended irony, No Child Left Behind, NCLB. Passed with strong bipartisan support, NCLB sought to improve our nation's K-12 education system by setting high standards and imposing an extensive testing regime on public elementary and secondary schools, along with draconian measures if the schools failed to achieve federally mandated progress. By the time I came to the Senate, there was a bipartisan consensus that NCLB was a disaster. During my 2008 campaign, I'd often say in my stump speech, I have not met one teacher in Minnesota who likes No Child Left Behind. Then in early October, a teacher took me aside. I like No Child Left Behind, he said quietly, because it disaggregates the data. Under NCLB, test data was broken down, and each subgroup of students at a school, black, Hispanic, American Indian, English language learners, students in special education, had to succeed in order for the school to be considered to have made adequate yearly progress. The teacher continued, that guarantees that schools are finally interested in how their black and Hispanic kids are doing. And he was absolutely right. You see, NCLB was a reauthorization of the original Elementary and Secondary Education Act, ESEA, signed into law by President Johnson. And like the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which made my dad and me Democrats, and the 1965 Voting Rights Act, ESEA was a civil rights bill, giving the federal government a bigger role in K-12 education to ensure the states were providing a decent education for all of their students. So the disaggregation of data became the second thing I liked about No Child Left Behind, the first being the name. Otherwise, the law was a disaster. If a school failed to make adequate yearly progress for 4 years in a row, it would have to undergo a federally mandated restructuring. In some cases, schools would be forced to fire and replace 50% of their teachers and their principal. This made no sense, for example, in rural areas where there are teacher shortages. A number of rural school superintendents told me about two failing schools in their district, which just swapped their principals and half their teachers, showing the sort of problem-solving ingenuity that I dearly hope they pass on to their students. NCLB had a whole host of wildly stupid rules. For example, students would take their NCLB tests in late April, which meant that the school wouldn't get the results until well after the school year had ended, at which point it was too late to use the results to actually help the students. Hence, educators referred to the test results as autopsies. Another stupid thing. Schools were judged by what percentage of students met or exceeded proficiency. That created a perverse incentive for teachers to focus on kids in the middle, students right below and right above this arbitrary proficiency benchmark. Teachers in Minnesota call this a race to the middle. They could ignore the kids at the top because they knew those kids would never fall below proficiency. And they could ignore the kids at the bottom because there was almost no chance that those students would reach proficiency that school year. This proficiency thing was nuts. A sixth grade teacher who takes a kid from a third grade level of reading to a fifth grade level of reading is a hero, not a failure. More stupidly, the tests were not allowed to measure students' ability outside their grade level. A fifth grader could only take a test designed to show whether or not he could read at a fifth grade level. If your son couldn't read at a fifth grade level, wouldn't you want to know whether he was reading at a fourth grade level as opposed to a second grade level? Tough. The NCLB test didn't do that. It only measured for fifth grade proficiency and gave no answer more detailed than pass or fail. That's why many Minnesota schools started administering a computer adaptive test in addition to the mandated NCLB test. These tests were far more useful. For one thing, they were on a computer, meaning teachers could get the results for each kid right away and use them to inform their instruction. For another, they were adaptive, meaning that if a kid was answering questions correctly, the questions would get harder and vice versa. That way, the teachers could see at exactly what grade level each student was testing. Teachers, principals, and superintendents in Minnesota all told me they preferred the computer adaptive test. But this meant that students had to take both tests. And because the stakes were so high, that meant a lot of test prep, or what teachers referred to as drill and kill. It reminded me of the McNamara fallacy, named for Robert McNamara, Kennedy and Johnson's data-driven Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War. The McNamara fallacy is this: what can be measured will be measured, and what cannot be measured won't be measured, and only things that are measured are deemed important. Hence the drilling and killing. Teachers spent all their time trying to get their kids to learn certain discrete skills that they knew would be tested. Not on the test, and therefore not in the lesson plans, were things like critical thinking, creativity, the ability to work with others, and love of learning. All of which are kind of important, or at least I'm told, you know, by employers. By the time I got to the Senate, everyone knew that NCLB needed to be reformed. We held lots of hearings and talked to lots of witnesses. There was a lot of agreement on what wasn't working, and we all took turns vehemently agreeing about it. In other words, we did a lot of what we in Washington call admiring the problem. So why did it take 7 years to get it done? Well, that whole two contradictory ideas thing works both ways. Even as we were finding ourselves in agreement on what we needed to do, Republican leaders were working to prevent us from actually doing it. The entire time Democrats held the majority in the Senate, we couldn't break through to even bring a K-12 education bill to the floor. But after Republicans took the majority in the 2014 election, we started to see some things move. Ironic, you might think, but not really. As Minority Leader, Mitch McConnell's goal was almost always to stop Obama and Senate Democrats from getting things done, to prevent us from having achievements we could point to. But Obama wouldn't be on the ballot in 2016, and McConnell was suddenly interested in getting some things done so that his majority could have something to show for itself. But hey, after 6 years, Democrats were willing, hell eager, to go along with it. We believe in government, after all, and even if it meant Republicans got a lot of the credit, we were happy to be moving forward on long-delayed priorities like a 5-year highway bill and, at long last, education reform. At the outset, Republican Help Committee Chairman Lamar Alexander put together a totally partisan Republican bill, which ranking Democrat Patty Murray and the rest of us refused to take up. After that initial exchange, Lamar and Patty got down to business, working together on a truly bipartisan bill in an exemplary way. I have tremendous admiration for Lamar Alexander. Time and again, he'd call a hearing, and the night before, I'd read through the testimony of the next day's witnesses, only to discover that one after another was planning to say something that I knew Lamar didn't agree with. In other words, he was willing to call witnesses who offered opposing views, and he always listened carefully. That, by the way, is why I was so disappointed when he took one for the team by cutting off questions after one round during the confirmation hearings for Trump nominees Betsy DeVos and Tom Price. I assume because the questions were revealing that DeVos didn't know the first thing about public education and that Price had a long history of suspicious stock purchases. More on those hearings later. The bill we passed in 2015 represented the 80% or 64% that Senate Republicans and Democrats finally realized we agreed on. Schools would still have to test every year between third and eighth grade and once in high school. But each state would control its own testing, and that would almost certainly mean fewer high-stakes tests. Meanwhile, we would invest more in early childhood education, which Democrats liked, but not enough, which Republicans liked. But everyone got to say we'd done something about early childhood education, which everyone liked, because the impact is so clear. Inequality in education starts early, and it starts at home. A study by the University of Kansas found that by the time she is 3 years old, a child who grows up in a home on welfare will hear 30 million fewer words than a child who grows up in the home of a professional family. Words like portfolio and equestrian. Actually, that's not 30 million distinctly different words. I don't think there are 30 million words. During the study, researchers found that children from welfare families heard on average about 600 words an hour. Children from professional families heard 2,100 words an hour. We know that kids who have had quality early childhood education are less likely to be placed in special education, less likely to be left back a grade, more likely to have better health outcomes, less likely to get pregnant in adolescence, more likely to graduate from high school, more likely to go to college, more likely to get a good job, and less likely to go to prison. The return on investment in quality early childhood education can be as high as $16 for every dollar spent. If we really wanted to address future deficits, we would be pouring money into training early childhood educators. Didn't happen here, though. The law we passed put more funding into after-school programs, more funding into school counselors, more funding for mental health in schools, although not enough of any of it. There's also more, but not enough funding for STEM skills, science, technology, engineering, and math, which are necessary for so many 21st century jobs. When I think about after-school programs and STEM skills, I don't just think of the academic literature on school achievement. I think of FIRST Robotics. In FIRST Robotics, high school teams build and program robots to compete against other schools in a complex game, which changes every year, like hitting a target with a frisbee and climbing a jungle gym. Believe it or not, there are now more high school FIRST Robotics teams in Minnesota than boys' varsity hockey teams. When the team from East Duluth finished 10th in the world championships a few years ago, I went up to highlight their achievement at an auto body shop where they were building their new robot. The fabrication co-captain, a sophomore named Anna Karras, introduced me to the programming co-captain, the business co-captain, and the media co-captain. Then Anna did an interview with the three Duluth camera crews that showed up for the event. "What does it mean to you that three cameras are here today?" one of the producers asked. "It's very in line with our media strategy," Anna answered. "I don't worry about Anna. With millions of self-replicating, tireless robots as her obedient slaves, there's almost no limit to what she can accomplish in the future." A number of my amendments didn't make it into the bill. Take, for example, my Student Non-Discrimination Act. SENDA would give LGBT students the same rights that students have on the basis of race, disability, and gender, including the private right of action, the right to sue. There has been an epidemic of bullying of LGBT students across the country. Many LGBT kids have committed suicide. 30% of LGBT students report missing a day of school in the last month because they're afraid. For years, I tried and failed to get a Republican co-sponsor. One night, I called a good Republican friend of mine. Me. My amendment gives LGBT kids and their parents a private right of action. My colleague. Well, the kids will just act more gay so they can sue. Me. Oh, no, no, no. That's not what would happen. You just watch. Me, silently. Ay. But there's one amendment that I did get through that I am as proud of as anything I've done in the Senate. It's not uncommon for foster children to have 10, 11, 12 sets of foster parents during their childhood. This wreaks havoc on their education. If a child's new foster parents live in a different school district, the foster child is yanked out of school and sent to one in the new school district. Sometimes the kids fall through the cracks. Kayla Van Dyke, an impressive high school senior from Minnesota who has been in 7 foster homes, testified to the HELP committee that she had missed 4th grade entirely. For foster kids, school is often the one constant in their lives. Maybe they have a teacher they really like, or an extracurricular activity that means everything to them. Or maybe they have these things called friends. My amendment was simple. It allowed foster kids to choose to stay in their school if they wanted to. That meant the school district and local social services would have to find a way to pay for their transportation. At first, almost all of my Republican colleagues were against it. After all, it was a federal mandate, requiring local school districts to spend money. But after 6 years of talking to my colleagues one-on-one, they had come to see the wisdom of my proposal. The amendment passed overwhelmingly and became part of the new law. I like to think that somewhere there's a foster child running cross-country or developing a passion for history because of a great teacher or doing homework with a good friend because of the legislation I worked hard on. Legislation that passed with a strong bipartisan majority. And my fervent hope is that kid will grow up to run for the Senate as a Democrat and knock off a Republican incumbent. If we want to help kids, especially kids who don't have all the advantages that I had and that my kids had and that my grandkids are going to have, then one education bill isn't going to do it. And just focusing on education itself isn't enough. For example, kids who grow up poor are far more likely to suffer what are called adverse childhood experiences. Not just the stress of living in poverty itself, but domestic violence, abuse or neglect, the incarceration of a parent, the death of a sibling, all of which affect brain chemistry and the ability to learn. If we want to improve education, we need to do a better job of helping these kids overcome these traumas and a better job of addressing economic inequality so that fewer have to deal with trauma in the first place. Which means we need to create more prosperity and do it in a way where everybody gets to prosper. Which means we need to invest in our infrastructure and in research and development and in innovative technologies and in our workforce. And most of all, in our kids. Which would be a hell of a lot easier if our political system wasn't broken. It's going to be hard to unbreak it as long as Republicans continue to hold a lot of power. It would be great if someday soon we had a Democratic president and a Democratic House and a filibuster-proof Democratic majority in the Senate, or really any of those things. And a huge part of what all of us have to do from here on out is to fight back to win back the country, up and down the ballot. We have to organize from the grassroots on up. We have to make our case to the public, and we have to go on offense. But in the meantime, on Capitol Hill, I still believe that the 64% rule applies. Just because we're out of power doesn't mean we abdicate our responsibility to try to improve people's lives. That's what makes us Democrats. It's what makes us worth electing in the first place. Of course, now that Donald Trump is president, even 64% might be a little optimistic. I figure we're going to spend some portion of our time trying to stop him from giving Alaska back to the Russians. Let's say we spend 60% of our time on stuff like that instead of making progress. Doing the math, that means we're down to, 64% times the remaining 40%. Okay, 25.6%. But I'm an optimist, so let's round up. 26%. And, of course, our new Secretary of Education is a right-wing ideologue who hates public schools, so maybe education isn't going to be in that 26% for a while, but something else will be. I can't think of anything right now. ISIS? Opioids? Cybersecurity? Sentencing reform? Maybe that Victor Borges stamp from a couple chapters ago. There's plenty to choose from. Chapter 36. My Republican Friends. Okay, maybe 26% is a little high. Maybe it's more like 20% or 15, or maybe you're just a total pessimist and you think it's closer to 2%. But even if 98% of the time we're at an impasse, there's progress to be made in that 2%. Remember how my dad's quilting factory failed because the railroad wouldn't stop in Albert Lea to pick up his goods to bring to market? That's an example of something called captive shipping. In much of America, railroads enjoy a monopoly and are able to charge farmers and manufacturers exorbitant prices to carry their products. If you don't pay, the railroad doesn't stop, and you have to move to St. Louis Park to become a printing salesman. The Surface Transportation Board, STB, has jurisdiction over railroads. And just as George W. Bush invaded Iraq to avenge his own father, I wanted to make it easier for someone who had been the victim of captive shipping to do something about it. When I first got to the Senate, it cost $20,000 to lodge a complaint with the STB. If you're a small farmer watching freight trains zip through your community without stopping because you can't afford to pay the monopoly prices to the railroad, you tend not to have $20,000 lying around. I wanted to put pressure on the STB to lower the fee for lodging a complaint. But as is almost always the case, the odds of success were going to be far higher if I had a Republican partner, which is how I ended up working with David Vitter, an extremely conservative Republican with whom I almost never agreed and whose personal conduct I was repulsed by. Google it. Together, David and I got the STB to lower the fee to $350. And then we went back to voting against each other pretty much all the time. I've worked with John Bozeman from Arkansas on improving health care for veterans. I've worked with Deb Fisher from Nebraska on increasing access to rural broadband. I've worked with Bill Cassidy from Louisiana on addiction issues. I'm working right now with Tom Tillis from North Carolina on funding housing and wraparound services for people with mental illness. They're all extremely conservative Republicans who, I'm sure, don't want me to say anything good about them. And make no mistake, I hope they all get beat in their next elections. But they're there right now. And just as part of my job is standing my ground against all the terrible things they want to do, part of it is looking for opportunities to find common ground, because that's how stuff gets done. You see, there are only 100 of us senators, and none of us can do the job without working with the other 99. Mike Mansfield had a saying, "It only takes one senator to make a scene, but it takes more than one to make a difference." Okay, he never said that. I made it up. But if he had, it certainly would have made my point, which is that, sure, a lone senator can hold things up with a filibuster or some other procedural maneuver, but actually passing legislation takes teamwork. Very often, the only way a bill stands a chance is if you can find a co-sponsor in the other party, to make it bipartisan. Sometimes you have a regional issue that requires you to cooperate with colleagues from neighboring states, even if you and said colleagues don't see eye to eye on pretty much anything else. For example, there is a history of flooding in the Red River Valley between Minnesota and North Dakota, so it's really important that North Dakota Republican John Hoeven and I be able to work together to fight for flood mitigation funding. That's why we have all these unwritten rules, like addressing each other as my esteemed colleague, even when we may, in fact, esteem each other very little. It's why you're not supposed to smirk or roll your eyes when someone else is giving a speech on the floor and you're presiding. That would be a real jerk move. It's why, as silly as it may sound, it's important that we try to like each other. That's right, like each other. Not just the Lamar Alexander types either. In my view, you've got to build friendships with the Jeff Sessions types too. Like, for example, with Jeff Sessions. When I first got to the Senate, Jeff was the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, and I made it a point to go to every hearing, no matter how perfunctory. Often, we'd have a nomination hearing for a judge whose confirmation was completely non-controversial, and it would just be the chairman, Patrick Leahy, Jeff, and me. I wasn't just there because I had nothing else to do. I was there to prove that I had come to the Senate to work, not be a clown. And Jeff took notice. He saw me show up for every hearing. He heard me take the responsibility of questioning the nominees seriously. And even though he probably agreed with literally nothing I said, he quickly grew to like the cut of my jib. A few weeks in, Chairman Leahy had to miss a hearing, so he asked me to fill in. I arrived early, and when Jeff got there, he saw me sitting in the chairman's seat holding the gavel. "Well," exclaimed Jeff in his thick southern drawl, "a meteoric rise." "And well deserved," I replied in my nasal Midwestern Jewish twang. Jeff laughed. He's been an easy laugh for me ever since, except at his confirmation hearing. Anyway, the point is, Jeff liked me, and here's why I like him. A few years later, the Judiciary Committee was holding a hearing on a Dianne Feinstein bill to protect American citizens apprehended within the United States on terrorism charges from being detained indefinitely without a trial. One of the witnesses was Stephen Bradbury, a lawyer who had written one of the Bush administration memos inventing some flimsy legal rationale for torture, thus contributing to the decline of our reputation on the world stage, inflaming anti-American sentiment in the Middle East, and putting our troops in more danger. I wasn't really interested in hearing this guy's thoughts on due process, and I told him so. "It's very difficult for me, frankly, to rely on your legal opinion today," I said, suggesting that someone with his record had no business testifying before the committee. It was pretty aggressive by Senate committee standards, so aggressive, in fact, that my questioning really offended some of the Republicans on the committee. But I didn't know that until Jeff was kind enough to call me and give me a heads up that I should probably cool it for a little while. It was a real act of friendship. I had had no idea that I was digging myself such a hole with my colleagues by teeing off on this ghoul, and I really appreciated that Jeff was gracious enough to clue me in so I could back off just a bit. When Trump won the election and nominated Jeff to be Attorney General, it was time for me to return the favor by setting aside my very real concerns about his record and the Trump administration's plans for the Department of Justice and just waving his nomination through. No, of course not. Being a senator does mean finding a way to make friends with people you're fighting against with every fiber of your being. But it also means finding a way to fight with every fiber of your being against people you're friends with. I rarely voted with Jeff when he was a senator, and that's fine. Senators disagree. But I knew that, as Attorney General, he would represent a clear and present danger to the civil rights of millions of Americans. And his confirmation hearing would be my opportunity to raise that alarm. Which I did, without apology, calling him out for overstating his involvement in civil rights cases, and holding his feet to the fire on Donald Trump's fear-mongering about voter fraud, which, of course, is nothing more than a pretext for voter suppression. And then I voted against him. Jeff Sessions is my friend, or was. Franny is friends with his wife, Mary. When our grandson Joe was born, Mary knit him a baby blue blanket, which became his favorite. It's hard to unfairly demonize someone whose wife knit your grandson his favorite blankie, which is why when my job meant doing everything in my power to deny my friend this important position, I was relieved that there was so much to fairly demonize him for. For my part, I've tried to create more opportunities for us senators to be nice to each other. For example, at any given time, we have 30 or so pages working in the Senate. Pages are high school juniors, 16-year-old kids, who come to Washington to spend months helping out with day-to-day operations in the Senate chamber. They all live together in a dorm, and if I were a parent of one of them, I realized, I would want to know that senators were keeping an eye out for them and helping them to have a positive experience. So, Franny and I teamed up with Mike and Diana Enzi to start a tradition of throwing pizza parties and ice cream socials for these kids. Pages are generally not allowed to initiate conversations with senators, so Mike and I give them an opportunity to ask us questions like, is being a senator as much fun as being on Saturday Night Live? Or in Mike's case, is being a senator as much fun as being an accountant? Another initiative I spearheaded over the repeated and grumpy objections of Harry Reid was our annual Senate Secret Santa. I modeled it after the Secret Santa we had back in elementary school in St. Louis Park. The idea was that every kid would get a gift, but also that every kid would have to learn something about someone they maybe didn't know and do a nice thing for them. I figured it would be a fun, bipartisan thing for us to do, and because every senator who participated would get a present, no senator would get his or her feelings hurt. One year, though, Jeff Flake, an iconoclastic Republican from Arizona, kind of hurt my feelings by giving me a crappy present. A hat bearing the logo of Ping, which apparently is a golf equipment company based in his home state. I complained about it to Tim Kaine. Flake gave me this stupid hat. This is the worst Secret Santa gift ever. What was he thinking? Staff error, said Tim. He's really smart and would make a great vice president. God damn it. Now I'm depressed. Let's move on. Not surprisingly, the quickest way to my heart is through my funny bone, which isn't the elbow, but rather the rib that lies directly over the heart. Aw. And my favorite Republican colleagues aren't the ones whose politics are the least objectionable, but rather the ones with the best senses of humor, no matter how objectionable their politics may be. Pat Roberts has got to be near the top of that list. As I mentioned earlier, he loves Bob and Ray, but he loves Jack Benny even more, and he has a little bit of that famous Jack Benny comic timing. When I see him in an elevator or in the Senate subway, I usually greet him with a, "May I help you?" in the annoying voice of character actor Frank Nelson, a regular on the old Jack Benny program. Pat replies with a great Benny-esque, "You again." And then we laugh. No one within earshot has a clue what we're laughing about, and odds are neither do you, but we don't care. And though our politics couldn't be more different, we always jump at the chance to work on something together. For example, the regulations on drug compounding, which is when pharmacists mix prescriptions themselves from individual ingredients. Well, they were very confusing, and in 2012, 800 Americans contracted fungal meningitis, and 64 died due to unsafe drugs that shouldn't have been allowed to be distributed. Pat and I discovered that we both wanted to work on this issue, so we teamed up and closed the loopholes. Then there was a time I needed Republican votes for an amendment to get $11 million for energy projects in Indian country, so I asked Pat. He stood with me in the well of the Senate, doing his best to urge his Republican colleagues to help me. And by his best, I mean that Pat told them, leadership describes this as completely innocuous. I got the votes. Pat's funny, but the funniest Republican in the Senate is Lindsey Graham. Most of his jokes are of the we're in a cynical business variety. For example, before our Christmas break one year, Lindsey asked me if the Frankens were going anywhere for some sun. I told him we were going to Puerto Rico. Without missing a beat, Lindsey gave me some advice. Do two fundraisers, one with the folks for statehood, one with the folks against statehood. They never talk to each other. In 2016, Lindsey ran for president and found himself somewhere around 15 in a field of 17. Running into him in the senator's bathroom, I told him, Lindsey, if I were voting in the Republican primaries, I'd vote for you. Again, without hesitation, he replied, that's my problem. Believe it or not, however, not every senator has a great sense of humor. Tom Coburn and I did not hit it off right away. A terrifyingly conservative Republican from Oklahoma, he was known as Dr. No for two reasons. First, Tom's an obstetrician-gynecologist. Second, he is an adamant federalist who believes the federal government has appropriated too much power from the states, which means he's pretty much opposed to Congress doing anything. But that's not why we didn't hit it off. Our first four or five interactions were just misses. Nothing terrible. Mainly, he just didn't seem to get where I was coming from. So I approached him at a Judiciary Committee hearing to take another shot at breaking the ice. Tom, can I buy you lunch? Tell you what, he said. Buy me breakfast. We sat down together a couple days later in the Senate dining room around 8 a.m. I had given some thought to how I wanted to start. Tom, I said cheerily, let's have fun. We can talk about anything, politics, our families, our careers, but let's make sure to have fun. Sure, he nodded. Fun. Okay, I said, careers. Let me ask you something. To be a doctor in Oklahoma, do you have to have any formal education? Yes, he exploded angrily. You have to go to medical school. Ah, I had identified our problem. Okay, I explained. That was a joke. Tom understood immediately and calmed right down. You see, that's what I used to do for a living. I told jokes. I was in comedy. We did have fun for the next 45 minutes, and he wrote me a lovely note thanking me for breakfast and for the fun, which seemed like it had been a novel experience for him. Tom retired from the Senate after 2014 with a nearly perfect record of voting against everything I like. But when I called Tom a few months ago to make sure it was okay with him if I told this story, he agreed right away. You're a gentleman to ask, but there's a First Amendment. You can write anything you want. It was very Tom Coburn. Then we had some fun talking about grandchildren. I should note, I like my Democratic colleagues too, but I spend a lot more time with them and we agree on stuff, so it's easy to like them. It's harder to make friends across the aisle. And it's also more important. It's a lot easier to negotiate with people you trust and whom you don't personally dislike. And that's why you fight as hard as you can for your principles, but try not to be a jerk about it. It's why it's important that your word is good. It's why it's important to try to build these relationships with colleagues across the aisle, whether it's through family bonding or inside jokes or writing a country song together, which I did with Orrin Hatch. It's called We Stayed Together for the Kids, and I needed a bridge. When Orrin and I were working on it in his office, Orrin's scheduler called my scheduler and said, I don't know what's going on in there, they're just laughing. And the song kind of went like this, We stayed together for the kids. It was what we thought we had to do. But now the kids are up and gone, and there's just me and there's just you. That wasn't the bridge. Unfortunately, building those bonds is harder now than it used to be. For one thing, members of Congress used to bring their families to Washington to live. Members would see each other on weekends or just hang out. Their kids used to go to school together in D.C. or suburban Maryland or Virginia. It's hard to hate the parent of a kid who's on your kid's baseball team. To a great degree, the 1994 election changed that. Newt Gingrich told Republicans to run against Washington. They did, and they won. He told them to keep their families in their home districts, and they did. And for some of them, it put pressure on their family life. Newt, for example. But mostly, it meant that members would fly into D.C. on Monday afternoon and fly out on Thursday afternoon, a practice that has continued to this day. Meanwhile, our schedules have got more packed than ever. Every minute we don't spend fulfilling the requirements of our jobs, we're expected to spend raising money. And we're also expected to spend as much time as possible in our states, which doesn't leave a lot of time for getting to know and therefore trust your colleagues. At the end of the day, the Senate is like any other workplace. You don't always enjoy all of your coworkers, but you're far better off finding a way to get along with them than you are harping on the things you don't like. And being a successful senator is as much about being a good coworker as it is about being smart or well-versed in the issues or a talented orator. If you can be a pleasure to work with, you'll get more accomplished than if you're a pill whom no one can stand. Which brings me to Ted Cruz. Chapter 37, Sophistry. As I mentioned in the last chapter, there are unwritten rules of the Senate that everyone follows in order to maintain civility and foster productive working relationships. One of those unwritten rules is that you aren't supposed to repeat in public a conversation you've had with a colleague in private if that conversation makes your colleague look bad in any way. I've decided to observe that practice in this book with one exception, Ted Cruz. For what it's worth, I feel fully justified in doing so because Ted violated basic Senate protocol himself when he went to the floor and called Mitch McConnell a liar. It was the sort of thing that just isn't done, a breach of decorum so shocking that even I haven't committed it, and I love calling people liars. Anyway, here's the thing you have to understand about Ted Cruz. I like Ted Cruz more than most of my other colleagues like Ted Cruz, and I hate Ted Cruz. The reason I like Ted more than most of my other colleagues do is that he actually has a decent sense of humor. Ted has tried out jokes on me. They're usually pretty pedestrian, usually I can see the punchline coming, and many are not very good versions of constructions I've heard before. But as politician jokes go, they're not bad at all. And Ted is a fan of comedy, I think. You're never entirely sure with this guy. One Monday, after a week's recess, Ted came up to me on the floor to tell me that he and some friends had watched a rerun of my Stuart Smalley sketch with Michael Jordan and raved about how funny it was. I think he was being sincere, which meant it was a genuinely nice gesture. The only problem was that at that moment, I was talking to my friend Jeff Sessions about our respective recesses, and now I had to try to explain to Jeff what Ted was talking about, which meant I had to explain what recovery is, what affirmations are, what public access TV is, what a parody of public access TV is, and I had to do it all in about 30 seconds before Jeff lost interest, which of course I failed to do, and Jeff just kind of faded away to talk with someone else. Great. Anyway, Ted has a sense of humor, even if it's a lame one. And he did pay me a modest compliment, even if it was some Machiavellian ploy in service of his ambition to take over the world. The problem with Ted isn't that he's humorless. It isn't even his truly reprehensible far-right politics. No, the problem with Ted, and the reason so many senators have a problem with Ted, is simply that he's an absolutely toxic coworker. He's the guy in your office who snitches to corporate about your March Madness pool and microwaves fish in the office kitchen. He is the Dwight Schrute of the Senate. In a way, he's a perfect example of what I said in the last chapter about how it's not your knowledge of policy or your political talents, but rather your people skills that determine whether you succeed as a senator. For sure, Ted is extremely smart. Only the most brilliant young lawyers get to clerk for Supreme Court justices, and Ted got to clerk for Chief Justice William Rehnquist. And he's a truly gifted speaker who can frame an argument brilliantly. From what I've heard, when Cruz later returned to the court to argue cases in his capacity as Solicitor General of Texas, clerks would all make a point to be present in the chamber so they could watch him do his thing. I don't begrudge Ted that. There are plenty of senators who are smarter than I am or have more natural political aptitude than I do. For example, my own senior senator, Amy Klobuchar, or my friend Sheldon Whitehouse, one of the smartest people I've ever met, or Lindsey Graham. But I like them all, because none of them are sociopaths. Let me explain by telling you what I consider to be the quintessential Ted Cruz story. After the unspeakable mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School, Dianne Feinstein introduced a bill to reinstate the federal assault weapons ban, which was enacted in 1994 and expired in 2004. Now, there are plenty of things we could be doing to address gun violence that are overwhelmingly popular and aren't getting done only because Republicans have decided to refuse to do anything on guns, such as closing the loophole that allows people to buy guns at gun shows or on some websites without a background check. But there's a little more room for disagreement when it comes to the assault weapons ban. I, for one, wanted to co-sponsor Dianne's bill right away, but we have a very strong gun culture in Minnesota, and my advisors in the state urge caution. Why be in such a rush to back the bill? How am I going to feel when this happens again? I asked. But I understood why many of my constituents felt differently. I love football. There's no reason to love football as much as I love football, but people live for their pastimes. And one popular pastime, especially in Minnesota, is target shooting with AR-15s. Who am I to say that that's any more or less valid of a hobby than watching football players give each other concussions? Anyway, I wanted to treat the debate with the seriousness it deserved, so even though I decided to support the assault weapons ban, I made sure to listen to both sides. I even visited a gun manufacturer in St. Cloud where they made AR-15s. It's actually a great company. They have a terrific record of hiring veterans, but they are very much central casting pro-gun guys. The company doesn't make ammunition clips, just the AR-15s themselves, so I decided to start with something I thought we could maybe agree on. I asked why anyone would need a 30-round magazine to go hunting, and the manager shook his head and said, "If anyone needs 10 bullets to take down a deer." It seemed like we were finding some common ground, so why, I asked, would anyone need an assault rifle to go hunting at all? And one of the guys brought up feral pigs. Apparently they run in packs, and they're vicious. We don't have a lot of feral pigs in Minnesota, but they're evidently a real problem in parts of the South. "Has anyone ever been killed by a feral pig?" I asked. There was an awkward pause. Then someone said, "I heard of a guy who got bit in the leg." That didn't really seem like a reason to tote around an AR-15 with a 30-round magazine, but I didn't want to push my luck, so I asked, "Well, are they good eating, the feral pigs?" And one of the guys said, "If they're young." Okay, that wasn't a story about Ted Cruz, but it was a story about how fraught the debate was over the assault weapons ban and how I tried hard to take that debate seriously. And also, you learned something I bet you didn't know, which is that if you're going to eat a feral pig, you should eat a young one. Now, here's where Ted comes into the story. Back in Washington, Ted was taking absolutely no pains to listen to the other side. Instead, he was vehemently and theatrically opposing the bill with a series of fiery sermons on the Senate floor. And then one day he came up to me during a vote and said the following, Anyone who's for the assault weapons ban is engaged in sophistry. Sophistry is an SAT word, one that I had neither seen nor heard nor spoken since I was 16 years old. Our English teacher, Mr. Glenn, had assigned us a vocabulary book, and we were to learn 3 words a day. And one day, sophistry was one of the words. Sophistry is a form of argument that is intended to be deceitful. I don't think Ted knew that I was a co-sponsor of Diane's bill. I also don't think he knew that I knew what sophistry meant, which I think is why he used the word. But I played along. Why am I engaged in sophistry? Because, Ted said, Clinton's own Department of Justice did a study of the assault weapons ban and concluded that it doesn't work. No, it didn't, I replied. Actually, what the report said was that there wasn't enough data to reach a conclusion because the study was conducted only 2 years after the ban was implemented. Just read the report, Ted sneered in his pugnacious way. I think pugnacious was also one of Mr. Glenn's vocabulary words. I'll do that, I said with an edge of, truculence? After the vote, I took the Senate subway to my office and found Josh Riley, my judiciary counsel. Ted Cruz just told me that anyone who's for the assault weapons ban is engaged in sophistry. Josh, I should mention, is like Ted, a super whip-smart graduate of Harvard Law School. What's sophistry? He asked. I told Josh what sophistry is, and he nodded. What was his basis for that? He said it was because Clinton's Justice Department did a study that concluded that it hadn't worked. Josh frowned. That's not true. Then he proceeded to explain to me what I had already explained to Ted, that there wasn't enough data available at the time for Clinton's Justice Department to reach a firm conclusion. Still, I asked Josh to go find the Justice Department report and put a memo together so I could be prepared the next time I saw Ted. Josh went and found the Clinton Justice Department's impact evaluation, which was published in 1997, fulfilling the law's requirement that an analysis of the assault weapons ban be completed within 30 months of its enactment. And guess what? Josh and I were entirely right, and Ted was entirely wrong. The Clinton Justice Department wrote, "Our best estimate is that the ban contributed to a 6.7% decrease in total gun murders between 1994 and 1995, beyond what would have been expected in view of ongoing crime, demographic, and economic trends. However, with only 1 year of post-ban data, we cannot rule out the possibility that this decrease in gun murders reflects chance year-to-year variation rather than a true effect of the ban." In other words, the early results suggested that the ban might be working, but that there wasn't enough data to draw a definitive conclusion, exactly what I had told Ted. The next time I spotted Ted on the Senate floor, I approached him and said, "Well, I guess you owe me an apology." "Why?" "Well," I said, getting ready to hit him with some facts, "the last time we spoke, you said that anybody who's for the assault weapons ban is engaged in sophistry." To which Ted replied, "No, I didn't." As in a flat denial, not, "No, I didn't." Or, "Really? I said that?" Or, "That doesn't sound like something I'd say." It was just an unqualified, unequivocal, "No, I didn't." And that's when I realized that Ted Cruz was really something special. During the Judiciary Committee's first hearing on the assault weapons ban, Ted had engaged in his own odious brand of sophistry. First, he said this: "The assault weapons ban that used to be in effect, according to the Department of Justice, quote, failed to reduce the average number of victims per gun murder incident or multiple gunshot wounds victims." A 1999 summary of the 1997 report did say that. But that's very different from saying that the ban didn't work. In fact, the sentence immediately preceding the one Ted quoted said, "Evidence suggests that the ban may have contributed to a reduction in the gun murder rate, and murders of police officers by criminals armed with assault weapons. Ted continued, "Now that is the assessment of the United States Department of Justice, and that is in 1994. Actually, the Clinton Justice Department's report came out in 1997, and the language Ted cited actually came from a 1999 summary of that report. That kind of a mistake is very common in the Senate and in life, an innocent mistake, I'm sure, which is rare for someone as meticulous and or malevolent as Ted." Ted went on, "That was the Janet Reno Department of Justice under President Clinton that said the assault weapons ban was singularly ineffective."